A good morning, everyone. Hope everyone's enjoying their Hoshana Rabbah. And everyone is enjoying this gathering together on this Hoshana Rabbah night. As we are familiar in Simchas Torah, I have the I take the liberty of handing out these song sheets. So I'd like to be able to, just for a few songs, go through a few songs together, and then afterwards to share a few words about the significance about Hoshana Rabbah and a little bit about the Ushpizin as well. So let's begin on song number 3 on page 1. Ashrayam Shechachalo, Ashrayam Shashem Elaikam, Ashrayam Shechachalo, Ashrayam Shashem Elaikam. Shashem Elaikam. Look on page 2, and the copying machine didn't do such a great job. If you look on page 2, number 6, you may be familiar with this upcoming song. David Melech Yisroel Chai Chai Vikayam. 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 Israel, Chai, Chai, Vikayam. Melech Israel, Chai, Vikayam. Melech Israel, Chai, Chai, Vikayam. On numbers, song number 11, which is very hard to see, it's the one right in the middle on page 3. Kimitzion.
Kimitzion, Tetzé Torah, Dvar Hashem Yerushalayim.
We looked at the next page, song number 14. Mitzvah Gedolah Lios B'Simcha Tamid. That it's a tremendous mitzvah to be happy all the time, especially during the holiday of Sukkot, which is called Zman Simchaseinu, a time of our happiness. Mitzvah Gedolah Lios B'Simcha, Lios B'Simcha Tamid. Mitzvah Gedolah Liyad besimcha, liyad besimcha tamid. Mitzvah gedayla, liyad besimcha. Mitzvah gedayla, liyad besimcha, liyad besimcha tamid. Mitzvah gedayla, liyad besimcha.
We know these words right here. Nine, 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 nine.
We look on song number 21, Torah Sashem Timima.
Torah Sashem Timima. Torah Sashem Timima. Torah Sashem Timima. Meshivas Nafesh. Torah Sashem Timima. Torah Sashem Timima. Hashem Tehemima Meshivas Nafesh Heidos Hashem Nemar Avonam Machimas Machimas Besi Heidos Hashem.
Some sheets I'd like to be able to discuss a little bit about the mysticism as was on the handout, so I have to get a little bit into Kabbalah, if that's all right, for just a few moments. Okay. Even though when we think about Kabbalah, we think it's something which is very, very mystical, I once heard actually that someone was giving a class on Kabbalah 101, and he began, and it was the class was filled, so many people were there, and he began with the first words of Perkei Avos, Moshe Kibel Torah Misinai, and he began to just teach Perkei Avos. Kabbalah, in reality, means the giving over from one generation to the next, from one person to the next, is the concept of what Kabbalah is all about. But in addition, as you can see on your sheet over here, you may see that Kabbalah within the 10 spheros is actually something in which we say often, especially when it comes to between the holidays of Pesach and Shavuos, in which there is a time of Sfiras HaOmer. And there's special prayers that we say every day corresponding to these various spheros. Not the very top of Chochma, Bina, and Das, which correspond to, as it says, understanding, wisdom, and knowledge, which, by the way, is actually the acronym for Lubavitch movement of Chabad, which means Chochma, Bina, and Das. But when it comes to the discussion of these seven, it corresponds to something which we can greater relate to. And I'd like to share with you exactly how we can understand this, these concepts, especially when it comes to the Shviz and when it comes to the holiday of Sukkot and Hoshana Rabbah. Very interesting on Hoshana Rabbah, it corresponds to the taking of, one of the things that we do is we take the willow, the Arava, and we are to take it and to hit it onto the ground numerous times. That's part of the service in tomorrow's davening. And it's certainly worthwhile understanding why do we do such a thing? What is its significance? So to better understand the idea of the Arava, which is tonight, the concept of taking this Arava and tomorrow hitting it on the ground, I'd like to be able to first understand a little bit about these Sfirot. And if we, interestingly enough, it's no coincidence that these seven Sfiros, which we can see on our sheet, is Malchus, which actually is the last one, but we really begins with Chesed, then Gevura, which are on the opposite sides of one another, Tiferes, and then you have Netzach, Hod, Yesod, and then ultimately you have Malchus. Those seven, some explain, correspond to the seven mitzvos, the holiday of Sukkot. So what are the seven mitzvos? So we're familiar with many of them. First of all, we have the Arba Minim, that we take the lulav, you have an esrog, you have the Arevah, which we just discussed, the willow, as well as the Hadas, the myrtle. But in addition to those four, there's also the mitzvah of Sukkah itself, which we're in. Also in the times of the Beit HaMikdash, when the temple stood, there was the obligation of a chagiga, of bringing special offerings in the Beit HaMikdash during this time. And also there's a special mitzvah, it was Samachta B'chagecha. There's a mitzvah of simcha, to be rejoiceful specifically during this time of year. And perhaps if we could look at these seven sfirot, we can see the connection between these seven and the seven mitzvahs. But before I discuss those seven, there's actually another seven which corresponds to the holiday of Sukkot. And that's the Ushpizin, right? Every day or every night, and some people actually say the tfilos, that they welcome and usher in these various guests into their sukkah. And although there's a dispute, going chronologically, we have Avraham as the first night, followed by Yitzchak, then Yaakov, Yosef is the fourth night, Moshe and Aharon represent the fifth and sixth night, and ultimately David HaMelech is night number seven. And therefore tonight, the seventh night, represents the seventh person of the Ushpizin, David. And the question is, what exactly are we supposed to be thinking about? It's not like on Pesach when Eliyahu HaNavi comes and we shake the table or somehow he drinks a little bit of the wine. What exactly do we do with this guy, these guests? At least for Eliyahu HaNavi, we give him a cup of wine. What do we do for our guests? So the way that I like to understand this is that when we study each of these great individuals, the purpose of these Ushpizin is not just to invite them into our sukkah, but to invite them into our lives. To be able to learn from these people and to say, what can I do to be comparable to them? As it's brought down in the Tana de Eliyahu, one always must ask themselves the question, Masai yagiu masai l'masai avosai. When will my actions reach the actions of our forefathers? Which means the purpose of studying the Torah and looking at the great actions of our patriarchs and our matriarchs is not just to study what they did, but to be inspired to be able to be a little bit more like them. And therefore, I believe that's the that's how we correspond these seven Ushpizin, and that they represent how we ourselves should become better people, to grow, to be like them. In fact, before we delve into this chart over here for a moment, it's very fascinating, another point that I'd like to just illustrate very briefly. It's actually two times in the Haftorah. First time is during the beginning of Yom Tov, and then also on Shabbos, Chol HaMoed, we mention in the Haftorah a war, a futuristic war of Gog u'Magog. And some people wonder, what is the symbolism of wine, Zman Simcha Seinu, a time of rejoicing, that we have to think about a war, we have to think about a battle. We should be rejoicing over the fact that we have a sukkah, perhaps as the other Haftorah, the second day, which represents when the Beit HaMikdash was finally inaugurated in the days of Shlomo HaMelech. So we should be focusing on positive things, not on a war. So what exactly should we be thinking about when we hear the words Gog u'Magog? So certainly one could understand that as an external battle, that we have to actually fight a battle against this nation, this group called Gog u'Magog. But some explain that it represents an internal battle, something which is not from the outside but within ourselves. And what exactly is that internal battle? The idea of feeling that I can only accomplish a certain amount, that I feel, you know what, I have certain limitations, and I can't accomplish more than the limitations that I set upon myself. What we do is we create a roof. We put a ceiling and say, this is as far as I can go and no higher. That, in Hebrew, is called a gag. A gag is a roof. And perhaps the battle of Gog u'Magog in a sukkah is for us to say that we should have limitless potential. We should not create roofs above ourselves and say, this is as far as I can go, and I cannot reach any higher. But rather, we have to emulate the ways of a sukkah. We look at a sukkah that, although it has more shade than sun, we have the capacity to be able to look up and to be able to look beyond the roof, and to be able to look all the way to the stars, as though to say that we can achieve anything that we put our minds to, if only we'll be able to do exactly that. And therefore, if we have that perspective, that we look at our sukkah as an opportunity to grow as high as possible, then when you shvizen, when these guests come, then we can say, you know what, I can be, is to my ability, comparable to an Avraham. I'll never reach the level of Avraham, but at least I can emulate his actions. And therefore, this is one of the messages that one should have during the time of Sukkot. So therefore, I'd now like to continue by looking at this sheet and showing how the seven mitzvos correspond to the seven ushvizin, which correspond to these seven svirot, which are on the bottom. The very first, again, for those that have this sheet, you see that of chesed. Certainly when we think of chesed, out of all the seven, you would think of Avraham. And of course, he is the first of our guests. And in fact, of the Sfirot, that is the first of the Sfirot. After Chesed, after we have Keser, and we have, or Chochma, Bina, and Das, we now continue afterwards with Chesed. Avraham, of course, embodied Chesed. He was a person that was so much selfless that even the third day after a major procedure of Brit Milah at an old age, he wanted to sit outside of his tent so that he could find a guest. His whole life was chesed. And of course, that message is that we have to try to emulate that way somehow, to be like Avraham, to be like Sarah, to always use that opportunity to grow. But the other connection is the mitzvah of the seven mitzvos is that of a lulav. Avraham represents a lulav. Because the lulav, as we know, and all the four species, correspond to the various parts of one's body. The lulav represents a backbone. We know that Avraham Avinu lived in a generation where people did not believe in monotheism. There were idols all over, to the point that his own father had a whole storage house filled of idols. And we know the story, at a young age, he took an axe, he took a weapon, and he destroyed all of those idols. You can imagine the backbone that he had, as though to say, even though every single person is doing something, if I know that it's wrong, I am not going to stand for it. That's what Avraham Avinu was. A man who had that backbone, that lulav. And when we take that lulav in our hands on Sukkot, we're not just to shake it, but we're supposed to emulate the ways of that lulav. And that if we see something which needs to be spoken up for, that's precisely what we need to do. And a person should not be concerned about the way that people perceive them. We say in the Shema, Lo Yevash, we should not have busho, klima, we should not be embarrassed about our religious heritage. Rather, we should embrace it. We should feel comfortable and happy with that which we have as our rich tradition. And that's what Avraham represents, that of chesed. On the opposite side is gevura, is that of strength. We know that it says in Perkei Avos, Ezu Gibor, who is someone who is strong? Hakoyvesh Esitzra, someone who is able to control their desires. And you can imagine who's the next person, the next guest? It's Yitzchak Avinu. Yitzchak Avinu is the next of the Ushvizin. He represents the ultimate level of Gevura, because he was willing to be completely Moser Nefesh, not as a baby. Some say he was 37 years old when his father Avraham took him to be sacrificed in the difficult test of the Akedas Yitzchak. That's a tremendous nisayon, and he easily could have said, I can't do it. But he was Kovesh Yitzro. He was able to completely control and perfect his ability of allowing his father to do that which Hashem asked him to do. That is what we have to emulate. Do we have to have that inner gevura just like Yitzchak Avinu, to be able to control our yetzer, to be able to do that which we know is correct, and not allow our desires to get the best of us. And if we look at one of these seven which we're going to speak more about momentarily, of the seven mitzvos, we have the Arava. Yitzchak represents the willow. What's unique about the willow? The willow has no taste. The willow has no smell. Basically, it's something which is so plain that almost doesn't have an essence onto its own. Yitzchak, the greatness of Yitzchak, if you study what Yitzchak was, he was someone that did exactly what his father was. If you study the Torah, it's fascinating. You have a whole, so many stories about Abraham, so much about Yaakov, and then Yitzchak, very little discussion. The only things that we know about Yitzchak is the story of the Akedas Yitzchak. In fact, we know that he himself didn't go to find a wife. We know that the only time it mentions a story is when they were digging wells, and he was digging the wells of his father. And then ultimately on his deathbed, in which his eyes did not allow him to be able to see that which was in front of him. He was someone that almost had no agenda of his own, which is a very challenging thing to do. We often find that a great person, a great man or woman who achieves so much in their life, whatever it may be, the next, their child feels like a shadow. And it's so hard for them to be able to do the exact same thing that their father did, that their mother did. Because they know, how can I accomplish more than what my father has? He's one of the greatest individuals. Can you imagine being a Yitzchak? Everyone talks about how great your father, Abraham, is. And yet he did exactly the same thing, to the point that he almost had no identity of his own. That was the greatness of Yitzchak. What was amazing about Yaakov, and you can see on this chart, he's called Tiferet. Tiferet is the balance of the two, of Chesed and Gevurah. And Yaakov, as we know, was a person who had complete balance in his life. First of all, we know this when he's a man that, on one hand, he was Yoshev O'Halim, he knew tremendous Torah, but he also spent 20 years working. He was involved very much in Parnassah as well, in a livelihood. What's fascinating about the balance of Yaakov is we know that Yaakov represents Emes. Titein Emes LeYaakov. That's what we say in davening every morning. And we know that the word Emes is the most balanced word in all the Alephs. We have the Aleph, which is the very first letter. You have a Mem, which is the center letter. And then you have a Saf, which is the very last letter. MS represents complete balance. And that was the greatness of what Yaakov was. And therefore, he was able to take the virtues of his father, Yitzchak, his grandfather, Avraham, and to be able to find that counterbalance in between. Yaakov was a person who represented tremendous faith. And in fact, interestingly enough, we're sitting in a sukkah. He was the very first person to ever say the word sukkah. That, and very often, the way it's defined, how do you know what is the definition of a word? What you do is you have to study the very first time it's found in the Torah. And the very first time it's found in the Torah, it says that Yaakov made homes for his family, ulamiknehu asa sukkot, and for his cattle, for his livestock, he made sukkot, alkein kar shem makomahu sukkos. It's the very first time the word sukkos is mentioned. And interestingly enough, which we've discussed, a sukkah in its rawest form is translated as a barn, because he created sukkos ulamiknehu for his cattle. And of course, the symbolism of what we're supposed to do on Sukkot and our avodah in general is to elevate the most physical things to that which is spiritual. And that's the goal of what Yaakov tries to accomplish. Yaakov represents this element of Sukkot, of being able to elevate the most mundane things in his life. That even when he was involved in his work, he said that he was the most honest person. He never took a single thing. He was a man that embodied this element of being MS, complete truth in everything that he did. This was the trait of Yaakov. The next we find is Yosef. Yosef, interestingly enough, you would think should be either on the right side or on the left, but he's not. He's considered to be a sod. Yosef had a last name. His last name was Hatzadik. We know that there's an expression that Sadik Yisod Olam, that Sadik is the foundation of the world. And therefore, it stands to reason that when we look at this chart, we'd have to understand that Yosef represents Yisod. And we have mostly adults over here, you can understand by looking at this chart that his ultimate nisoyon, as you can see where this chart is, had to do with being tempted with the wife of Potiphar, in which she accused him of licentiousness, and to the point that he actually had to be incarcerated. So his actual, one of the greatness that you can see on this chart of Yesod represents how he was able to control that specific part. And when it comes to the mitzvos, of the seven mitzvos, when we think of Yosef, we think of the hadassim, the eyes. Hadass, the myrtle, is shaped as the size, is like the eyes, which represents a couple of things. That even though his eyes saw something, the wife of Potiphar, he did not take that which is not his. To the point that it said that anyone who is a descendant of Yosef HaTzadik, he cannot, well, there's no ayin hara, no evil eye will be placed upon such an individual, because he was able to control his eyes, and therefore that's the ultimate level to try to elevate ourselves on the night of Yosef, to be able to control what we see and what we should not see. Now, the other thing interesting about Yosef is that we know that when it came to the blessings that we say, and some people do this on Erev Yom Kippur, some do this every Friday night, that they give a blessing, Birchas Habanim. And the blessing that is given is not that your sons should be as great as Avraham, as Yitzhak and Yaakov, rather like Ephraim and Manasseh. Well, Ephraim and Manasseh, as we know, were the children of Yosef. So what was so special about Yosef and his children? It's because that he was able to live in the environment that he did. He was in Egypt, which was a corrupt society in which they were obviously involved in things which represented impurity. And yet he was able to remain Yosef HaTzadik. And therefore that's the message of what we need to emulate during this time. That was Yosef. And by the way, Yosef also had tremendous balance, which is exactly the same thing as Yaakov. In fact, we know that Yaakov loved, out of all of his children, who did he love the most? He loved Yosef. And it says, why ki ben zikunim? He was ben zikunim. What does it mean? It means he was a child of his old age. And all the commentators say, well, what do you mean? There was another child after Yosef. There's Benjamin. Benjamin was younger than Yosef. But Yosef had balance, just like Yaakov. They were very, very similar. And we see that is exactly what Yosef was. He was a person who was scholarly, but yet he was also worldly. He was a person who was able to be a politician, the viceroy in Mitzrayim, and yet retain his Jewish heritage. So this was the balance that he had. But the balance that he had represents more of the other two, of Netzach and Hoyd, which are the next two Shvizim. Netzach represents that of Moshe, and Hod is Aharon, the next two guests in our sukkah. On the fifth night, we invite Moshe Rabbeinu, and on the sixth, we invite Aharon. What is Netzach? Netzach, it's translated here as victory, mastery. Who could we think of but an individual who has mastered himself and all the things that he's accomplished, no one greater than Moshe Rabbeinu. And therefore, if we would think of one of the seven mitzvot that correspond to this holiday, and we would want to attribute it to Moshe, you would have to pick the Esrog. The Esrog, which, first of all, creates Hadar, which is beautiful and perfect in form. Also something which has a beautiful fragrance, a beautiful taste, which corresponds to someone who has Torah, someone who has Masen Tovim, who has the whole picture, everything. That was someone who Moshe was. And our goal, of course, to try to emulate those ways. Hod represents Aharon. Aharon represents the service in the temple, and we know that when it came to the garments of the Kohanim, especially the high priest, they were called Kavod L'Sifares. They were honorable and beautiful, distinct garments. And therefore, that's the same concept of what splendor, which is the beauty, which was represented by the garments of the Kohen Gadol. And obviously, if we want to think of the seven mitzvos, one of the seven mitzvos which represents Aharon the most in the service in the Beit HaMikdash is the Chagiga, which was the offering, the sacrifices that were brought specifically on this holiday in the temple, which would have been with the Kohanim and the descendants of Aharon. And then finally, on the seventh night, which is tonight, represents that of Malchus. Malchus, you'll see, interestingly enough, is all the way toward the top. It's by the mouth. And Malchus represents David. David
we know certainly someone who mastered the mouth. We read his Tehillim. We know that the way that we could improve and to be able to become better the way that we speak is by being cautious of what we say and to fill it with words of praise and supplication to Hashem, which is what David did. Therefore, Malchus is not just being a king, but it's ruling and having control over yourself and knowing how to speak, what to say, and what not to say. If we can think of any of the seven mitzvahs which would most be like that of David, it's the last mitzvah which we didn't yet touch upon, which is the mitzvah of simcha, of being happy. That even if you would study David's life, David did not have the most simplistic life. Not only was he involved in so many battles, but we know that he was unfortunately being chased by his predecessor. The king Shaul did not like him. He wanted him killed. And unfortunately, after he became a king, his own son wished to overthrow him from the Malchus. He unfortunately was a person that had so many different issues. And yet, despite his life's difficulties, he was able to make the most of his life. He was able to accomplish so much, and he didn't let all the challenges of his life drag him down, but rather he was able to somehow elevate himself through it all. That's the ultimate level of simcha, because we know that a person, who's that person who's wealthy? Soymech b'chelko. The concept of joy and being wealthy do not necessarily come hand in hand. You have to be able to make a life choice and say, I want to be happy, and it takes work. In fact, we know, we say life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Not necessarily happiness. It's an avoda. It takes work. But a person who wants to have the mindset has the capacity to have simcha in their lives. So even during this time of when you're in a sukkah, and you can think, well, how could I be happy? No matter where you are in life, even if you're cast out of a comfortable dwelling, you have the capacity to make that life decision. It's not easy. To be able to say, I wish to be like David. To be able to find the good things. To be able to find the great things in my life. And to be happy from those things. Ultimately, if the fact that Malchus, in conclusion, is by the mouth, it makes sense that the Arava, or Shana Rabba, is also shaped like a mouth. But there's a significant difference between David and the Arava. Because as we said, the Arava represents something which has no taste, represents something which has no smell, which represents, unfortunately, a Jew that is void of good deeds, void of knowledge, someone that unfortunately does not do the right thing. And therefore, the Arava, which is shaped like a mouth, perhaps represents someone that doesn't know how to speak properly. A person that speaks Lashon Hara, a person who doesn't say nice things to another individual. And it's very fascinating. What do we do tomorrow? We're going to take those aravos, we're going to take those willows, and we're going to smash them on the ground. And some people have the custom to hit them two times, three times. The Arizal says five times. Some say they have to keep hitting it until there's no more leaves. As though to say that the concept of not having the proper approach of my mouth, I need to rid myself of that, especially during this time. Time in which instead we need to emulate the ways of David, that of Malchus, being able to have majesty and control over our mouths and that which we say. And we know that that's true, as I mentioned on the first day of Sukkot, that when it came to the Arava and the Lulav and the Hadas and the Esrog, if in fact it represents different parts of our body, it makes sense there's one Esrog, one heart, one Lulav, one backbone. So why are there three myrtles? Why are there two willows? We don't have two mouths. We don't have three eyes. So as I explain, there are those that say that the Esrog represents the very first sin of man. That Adam and Chava, when they took of this beautiful tree, some say the Medrash states it was an Esrog. And therefore we need to take the Esrog and to undo their mistake and to be able to do a mitzvah with it. And if we look at the Hadas, there are three sets of eyes. Because in the picture that we know in Genesis, there were three sets of eyes. There was Adam, there was Eve, Chava, and there was the snake. But there were two mouths. Only two people ate. That, namely, Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve. And therefore, we take the Arava, which has two mouths, and instead of doing something improperly with our mouths, eating things that we shouldn't be eating, or saying things that we shouldn't be saying, we take those aravos and we hit them on the ground, as though to say that we wish to rid ourselves of not using our mouths properly, but rather to emulate the way of David, and also emulating the ways of everyone else. So God willing, when it comes to this time of Hoshana Rabbah, which is a time in which we say it's the end, someone we were talking about this before, that all of the din, all the judgments that's been going on from Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, it finally ends tonight. Because now we have the opportunity to finally internalize this message of all the Ushpizin and all the people that we're able to grow from and learn from. And not just from the Avos and the people that we've discussed, but to learn from one another. That we have different people in our community that have different qualities and different things they can contribute. Let's learn from one another. Let's grow from one another and not allow Gog and Magog to place limitations on ourselves. Rather, let's raise the roof and look above to be able to see all the way to the stars. And by doing that, the Samach B'Chagecha will truly be happy in our holiday. L'chaim. L'chaim.
L'chaim, Rabbi.
Beautiful.
Very beautiful, Rabbi.
We now continue with the next song, the Samach B'Chagecha. Song 29. The Samach B'Chagecha V'Aisa Asameyah The Samach B'Chagecha V'Aisa Asameyah
Very good job.
We have more pizza over here, so enjoy.
Great job, Rabbi. Really good.